Let's go ahead and get started with our class tonight. Thanks for being here as we continue on in our study in the book of Judges. Today's the 26th, and so we're going to plan to cover chapter 6, which covers Gideon, our next judge in line. We may, if time allows, cheat a little bit and start in on chapter 7, if time allows, but if not, no problem at all. Just as a quick recap for the benefit of those who were here and who weren't here last week, last week's topic was chapters 4 and 5, where we discussed Deborah, who is described as a judge, a prophetess, and Barak, who was a military commander in Israel at that time, and their endeavors against Sisera and Jabin, who was a king in Canaan at that time. So chapter 4 covered their victory over the Canaanites, and then chapter 5, you'll recall, was the song that both Deborah and Barak shared together, expressing their appreciation for God's deliverance of the Israelites from the hand of their enemies, but also highlighting that the leaders had stepped up and that the people had followed the lead and done what God expected them to do and purged the evil Canaanites from the land of Israel at this time. For today, though, we're going to start in on Gideon, and as I mentioned, I think at least in one class before, the account of Gideon serves as an inflection point in the narrative, in that the judges we've talked about so far, well, we know about them, that they were upstanding, courageous, especially Deborah, where she gave glory to God instead of put it on herself, and she led Barak and encouraged him to step up and lead as he needed to do. But Gideon, while he has certainly strengths and grows in his faith, as we'll see in the account tonight, really in our class next week, which will be chapters 7 and 8, we'll see where he faltered. And especially the legacy of his son, Abimelech, serves as an unfortunate conclusion to his life, in that what will happen in our class in a couple of weeks. So we'll start now on chapter 6. So looking at the beginning of chapter 6, you see that the people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. That's, again, an oft-repeated refrain that we've seen so far in the book of Judges, and it's part of that cycle that we've mentioned several times back from chapter 2, where it was the Israelites who failed to remain faithful to God. Then God raised up these plunderers, marauders, oppressors to the Israelites. In this case, it's the Midianites in verse 3, joined by the Amalekites and the people of the east. And we'll talk more about their activity against the Israelites in just a moment. This is all part of the cycle where God raises up these enemies. They come in and oppress Israel severely, which is elaborated on in the first few verses in chapter 6. Then the people cry out to God. He sends a deliverer to rescue them. And for a period of time, there's peace in that part of Israel after the judge delivers Israelites. So that same pattern is repeating itself here in chapter 6. So the Midianites here are oppressing the people of Israel so severely. It says actually that it was so severe in verse 2 that the people of Israel were made to live in mountain dens, caves, and other strongholds. The NET translates it a little differently and translates it in a way that indicates that they didn't live necessarily in these hiding places, but that they had to resort to storing their crops and other resources in these secret storage places to keep them from their enemies coming to plunder them. And so a picture of what that might have looked like. Would you have liked to live in a place like that? I definitely wouldn't have. But imagine living in caves or having to store your crops and your goods in places like this to keep your enemies from coming to take them from you. So farming and harvesting became extremely difficult since these enemies of the Israelites would plunder their crops. And it's very expansive. You notice that it says they went all the way to Gaza in verse 4. So that's towards the west on the shore of the Mediterranean there. So it was throughout the whole land of Israel. This was devastating, the havoc that they were wreaking upon Israel. Not just their crops, but also their livestock too. And so, you know, it's hard for us, I think, sometimes to relate to people in Bible times. But in my thinking, I thought, well, this is kind of equivalent to, you know, remember that there were no grocery stores back in these days. Okay, start there. So their lives depended on these harvests and their livestock. So imagine what it would have been like to have seen them completely decimated. It's like an equivalent for us today of all of the grocery stores in town burning to the ground, someone coming and stealing everything out of our pantry and refrigerator, and then slashing our tires so we couldn't get anywhere to get more food. It's a desperate situation. We take for granted, of course, how easy it is for us to get resources today, food-wise and otherwise, but imagine how hard they would have worked for these things and then for these enemies of theirs to come and completely take them away. But this was something actually that God had promised would happen to them when they became unfaithful to him. In Leviticus chapter 26 and verse 16, at the end of that verse, God says, "And you shall sow your seed in vain, for your enemies shall eat it." In that context, he's saying when they didn't keep God's commandments, when they didn't keep his statutes and his covenant, but break the covenant, that's what they should have expected, that their enemies were going to come in and take all of their resources from them. Does the name Midian ring any bells as far as your Old Testament knowledge, what happened before this account, the Midianites? Wyatt?
That's where Jethro and his family were.
That's right. So when Moses fled from Egypt, he went to the land of Midian. That's where he met his wife. Good point. He was also a shepherd for Jethro and married his daughter Zipporah. Even before that, though, the history goes back a little bit further.
They blocked Joseph.
That's right. So I think between Exodus and Joseph, the narrative goes from positive and friendly to negative and unfriendly, especially now that we're reading in Judges. Interestingly, Midian was one of the sons of Keturah, who was Abraham's wife after Sarah's death. That's in Genesis chapter 25, verses 1 and 2. So here we have the Israelites being oppressed so severely that they're either living in or having to store their crops in caves. It also describes the numbers several times in this account of Gideon, the numbers of these enemies of God as being like locusts. And that's also the kind of things that they're doing. So here's a picture of an olive tree that was stripped bare during a locust plague about 100 years ago. It reminded me of, in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 38, they're talking about individuals of faith, and not in relation to anyone specifically, I don't think, like Barak or Gideon, like we talked about last week. But at the end of Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 38, it says that those of faith wandered about in deserts and mountains and in dens and caves of the earth. So maybe alluding to times like these when the Israelites were forced to live in this way because of the oppression that they were under by their enemies. And again, I know I've made this point before, but it really can't be overstated how tragic this turn of events is, especially considering the strong leadership that we've read about so far of Othniel, Ehud, Shamgar, what we know about him, Deborah, and Barak. So they led the Israelites, had peace, but again, Israel has reverted back to unfaithfulness, and God has handed them over to these oppressors. Before I move on, though, I'll pause here to see if anybody has any questions or comments about the first six verses. All right, so picking up now in verse 7. Now, instead of immediately talking about a judge, we're told that God sends a prophet who remains nameless. Remember back in our class last week that Deborah was a prophetess? And I'll pause here just to make a comment that to me, in reading through Judges, it's a great comfort all the lengths that God goes through to discipline, rescue, and guide his people. So far in chapter 1, we read about him speaking to them whenever they asked who needed to go up to battle. And God in chapter 1 said, "Judah shall go up." So he's spoken to them. He sent his angel in chapter 2, who he'll send again in this chapter. He's raised up these judge deliverers that we've talked about, and in some cases empowering them with his spirit. And he sent prophets. So he's using all these different methods to reach out to his people, to help them, but also, as in this case, to remind them of his will, as we'll talk about in just a moment. We are greatly blessed today to have God's completed revelation where we can search for and understand his will. I think that's something that we shouldn't take for granted, different than what I think many of these people didn't have back during this time. So this unnamed prophet appears to the Israelites because they had cried out to God, because they were oppressed by the Midianites, And the content of the angel, the prophet's message, excuse me, is similar, I think, to the angel's proclamation back in chapter 2. You notice that he reminded them that God had delivered them from Egypt. He had provided for them a land in which to dwell. Further reminded them that he had forbidden idolatry, which they had engaged in repeatedly since being delivered from Egypt. And made it clear at the end of verse 10, that they had not obeyed. And that's where the message kind of cuts off. And so if you or I were someone listening to this proclamation by this angel, where he's reminding the people what God had done for them and saying, this is what I commanded you and you have not obeyed, then we should be able to put two and two together and understand that what God had promised as a consequence for such faithlessness was now what's happening. And that's what we're going to see Gideon misunderstanding. Because Gideon, as we'll see in a moment, is questioning, why is all this happening to us when God had made clear, when you are not faithful to me, these are the kinds of things that are going to happen. And you'll notice that, let me find the verse. Okay, verse 10, I said to you, I am the Lord your God. You shall not fear the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. So that phrase, I am the Lord your God, or I am Yahweh your God, you'll remember that that statement heads up the Ten Commandments back in Exodus chapter 20, showing its importance and its significance, the kind of relationship that God wanted with his people that up to this point the majority in Israel were not interested in. So that's where that section cuts off, that this prophet comes to the Israelites, makes this proclamation. They should have been able to put two and two together and understand that it was because of their own choices that they were in the situation that they found themselves in. And now the narrative is going to switch to Gideon in chapter 6 and verse 11. But before we go on to verse 11, I'll pause here again and see if anybody has a comment or question. JD?
In verse 7, we see them crying out to the Lord, and that happens time and time again. And what that makes me realize is that when they were oppressed, it was a punishment, but it also got their attention, and they cried out to the Lord. It turned out to be a good thing for them when they were oppressed, because when they were prosperous, they forgot about it. And then when he sent oppression, then they were reminded of their need for him. And they turn, call out to him, and the, you know, it's all part of the cycle, but it's actually the beginning of the good part of the cycle. It was both the bad and the good in a way. Also, when he says, I am the Lord your God, that's a reminder to them that's his covenant name. I have a covenant with you. You're not to be fearing these other gods. I am the Lord your God.
Good points.
Anybody else? Alrighty. So now in verse 11, the angel of the Lord, well, we read about an angel of the Lord back in chapter 2. Maybe this is the same one or different one, I don't know. But he comes and sits under a terebinth tree in Ophrah. Give me just a second. All right. That's a terebinth tree. So the angel comes and sits under this tree in Ophrah. It's unknown exactly where Ophrah was, but this property belonged to Joash the Abiezrite, if I'm saying that right. So this clan was part of the tribe of Manasseh. And remember we talked about a little bit last week, Manasseh, who I think when I was thinking about the class after last Wednesday, I was saying that Manasseh was one of the sons of Joshua. So that was wrong if I said that. Joseph. So Joseph had two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. And Manasseh had two different parts of Israel on each side of the Jordan River. So this clan, Joash and his clan of the Abiezrites, settled west of the Jordan River. And so what is Gideon doing when the angel appears under this tree in Ophrah? What's he up to? What's that? Yeah. He was working, but he was hiding his work. So this is a picture of winnowing wheat in a field. So from what I read, this would normally happen outside of the city where, especially like up on a hilltop where the wind would carry away the chaff and leave the wheat behind. But is that where Gideon's harvesting the wheat? No, we're told that he was using a wine press. So this is somewhere where they would have taken grapes and stomped the juice out of those grapes. You can imagine that a site like this would not be ideal for, as far as I understand it, threshing wheat, which again would normally be done on hilltops or windblown sweeps, but windblown slopes. Gideon could not or would not use the threshing floors for fear that the Midianites would see and confiscate the wheat. And again, we shouldn't read over that and just dismiss him as like, oh, well, that's unfounded. Again, this was their sustenance. He was afraid that the things that he needed to provide for himself and his family were going to be taken away, and he wouldn't be able to provide for them. So that's why he's being secretive about it or going about it in a different way to prevent that from happening. So the angel of the Lord appears to him and tells him in verse 11, "The Lord is with you, O mighty man of valor." And in this exchange between Gideon and the angel, you can see Gideon at a low and doubting place in his life, that he had been brought low by his circumstances, humbled for sure, but certainly didn't feel like a mighty man of valor like the angel is calling him here. There's a response from Gideon. He asks, how could the Lord be with the Israelites when they were experiencing such great oppression? And as you read through this account, does Gideon know at this point who he's talking to? He doesn't find out who he's talking to until verse 22, when it's clear that he had been talking face-to-face with the angel of the Lord. So, at least as far as my reading goes, he thinks he's just talking with someone, a person, who's building him up and calling him out to step up and deliver the Israelites. But again, he's very low and at a doubting place in his life. So there's this further back and forth between the angel and Gideon, wherein Gideon expresses his doubts about his abilities. He calls himself in verse 15 the least in his father's house. But the angel assures him of God's aid in battling the Midianites. And so at that point, Gideon tells the angel, who I don't think he knows is an angel yet, says, "Stay here while I return with a gift." And the angel obliges in verse 18. Does this account, as you read through it, as far as this message from God through his angel, remind you of another man who eventually became a leader but was hesitant and unsure about his abilities at first? Yes. There are a lot of similarities, I think, between this account of Gideon and Moses' reaction to God's commissioning him to lead Israel back in Exodus chapters 3 and 4. And my observation and takeaway from this is that we may read this and think, well, Gideon is humble. You know, he doesn't think too much of himself, which is a good thing. We shouldn't think higher of ourselves than we ought to. But fear and reluctance, which characterize Gideon, should not be misconstrued with humility. Because humility never precludes us from acting, doing what God wants us to do. And so in that way, Gideon is in, again, a fearful, reluctant state at this point. And so God has to work with him and does work with him patiently to bring him up to the place he needs to be to lead the people of Israel against their foes. Any questions or comments about the interaction between Gideon and the angel up to this point? Did you notice a change in who Gideon was talking to in the narrative? Yeah. So in verse 14, Corey, "And the Lord turned to him and said," so I don't pretend to know exactly what's going on here because different things have been suggested, but I thought I'd bring it up just because if you're reading through it, it's the angel that appears to Gideon, but then throughout the discourse, and as we'll note in just a minute, the angel's going to disappear at a certain point, but Gideon's still going to be talking to God. And so some have said, well, this is God appearing in human form, which is called a theophany. Could just be a matter of the angel or messenger speaking in the name of the one who sent him, being God, or that the angel was an intermediary vehicle through which God appeared to and spoke to Gideon. But it's true that the angel appears and speaking to Gideon, and then it's saying that Gideon was speaking to the Lord. The one counterpoint I have to it is that in verse 22, it says, Gideon perceived that he was the angel of the Lord. And so, to me at least, as far as the narrative goes, Gideon was speaking directly with an angel, who again, I think, appeared like a man, but Gideon comes to realize this wasn't just any normal man. So Gideon again says, don't leave this place until I come back with a gift. And from what I read, the nuance of that Hebrew word for gift is uncertain in this context. It could refer to a gift offered as a sign of goodwill or submission, which would have been appropriate in this case. In some cases, it's used of a gift offered to appease someone whom the offender has, an offer has offended. Or it could also carry a sacrificial connotation. So take that for what it's worth. But what was the gift? Well, Gideon comes back with a feast for his visitor. A young goat and unleavened cakes made from an ephah of flour, which I gather was about 6 gallons of flour, which is a lot, and could make about 30 loaves of our modern-day leavened bread. Again, he didn't make leavened bread. It was unleavened for the angel. But this was a feast. And again, considering this time of resource and economic scarcity speaks to Gideon's character, that he really went out of his way to provide for this angel. And this part of the account reminds me of Abraham's interaction with the angels in Genesis 18, except in that case, the individuals that Abraham was interacting with and that Sarah, I think, helped prepare the food for, they ate the food that Abraham brought them. But in this case, Gideon is instructed to pour the broth over the cakes and over the meat. And then the angel touches the food, the gift, with the staff that he was carrying. Fire comes from the rock and consumes the food. So at that point, the angel disappears. And how does Gideon react? In verse 22, it says, he perceived that he was the angel of the Lord, and he says, alas, O Lord God, for now I have seen the angel of the Lord face to face. And that term, alas, can also be translated ah, and it reflects a desperate and emotional cry, which is reflected in the way that God responds to him in verse 23, where he tells him, peace be to you, do not fear, you shall not die. So why would God have told him that if Gideon wasn't fearful he was about to die? So now Gideon understands who he had been talking with the whole time. And even in this episode, just in the course of these short verses and these minutes or hours that passed here, we can see growth in Gideon's faith, where he goes from doubting himself to now, upon learning that he had been interacting with the angel of the Lord and that he had been commissioned to lead the Israelites against their enemies, he builds an altar in verse 30, 24, and calls it the Lord is peace, which is a play on words from how God had consoled him in the previous verse by saying, peace be to you. All right, we'll get to that in just a minute. Let me pause here and ask if somebody has a question or a comment on Kyle.
I would just say it should put our hearts and minds at ease knowing that God is patient. And I think as long as we have a sincere, genuine heart towards trying to understand who God is and what he is and what he has done and all those things, similar to what you see playing out here with Gideon, that God will be patient with us. This is who God is. And if God is this way with Gideon, there's no reason why he wouldn't be that way with us, which I think is, you know, part of the learning that we have to do here. There are other instances, obviously, too, where maybe less sincere, less genuine people had kind of questioned God, and that didn't go too well for them. So we also need to kind of heed that warning and understand the difference between the two. But it should give us peace and hope that God is patient with us.
Yes.
Because we certainly need it.
Yes, very good point. I think you hit on the key there, which is what's the motivation behind it. So let me just scroll down in my notes. This is a New Testament example, but Matthew 16, verse 1, the Pharisees and Sadducees came, and to test him, they asked him to show them a sign from heaven.
And Jesus responds to them by saying, an evil and adulterous generation seeks for a sign, but no sign will be given to it except the sign of Jonah. So he left them and departed. So not to delve into exactly what was going on there, but we can see that they were demanding proof, but not with a pure motive. And Jesus responded sternly against that. But here, as you noted, God is very patient and works with Gideon, both in the angel appearing to him, and then, as we're going to see at the end of the chapter, the fleece, the sign of the fleece. And then even in the next chapter, right before battle, God gives them one more sign just to bolster his faith. And so you make a great point that, you know, we serve that same God today who wants to provide for us, has provided for us the proofs that we need, but also is patient with us, and we're very thankful for that. Yes, sir.
The thing is, you start to get to the prophets, and they reflect back on the patience of God in other occasions. And you know, here's this event in the Judges, and then we're going to have some more, and some more, and some more. And when you get to the time when Israel is about to be taken away, they're reminded that God has been patient with you all along, but you've not done what you're supposed to do. And sometimes people look at God as one who's terrible because he punishes. But look at all the places where he gave them plenty of chances.
Yes, very good point. Thank you.
All right. So that very night, God calls Gideon to action, and he commands Gideon to destroy his father's altar. Oh, Ed, go ahead. Oh, sorry. Someone had another comment. Wyatt, sorry.
I find it interesting that Gideon doesn't realize who he's talking to until right after the person he is talking to disappears.
That would be a clue.
Someone who vanishes from your sight that wasn't a normal person yet. So, good point. All right, God commands Gideon to destroy his father's altar to Baal and to cut down the Asherah, which either would have been a tree or a pole beside the altar to Baal. Again, representing both gods, Baal being the storm god, Asherah being the god, goddess of fertility, motherhood. And so again, to this secular, well, to this idolatrous society, very important things to focus on, victory in battle and fertility in the land. But God's commanding him, tear this down. He was then to construct another altar to the Lord, and using the wood that he had harvested from cutting down the Asherah to burn a sacrifice on it, the 7-year-old bull that God references as a burnt offering. Gideon complies with the help of 10 of his servants, but chooses a particular time to do it, and that was at night, and that was to conceal it from who? He did it to conceal it from his family and the men of the town. And as we'll talk about in just a few verses, for good reason, because they do not respond well to him doing that. To point out quickly here, you know, again, something that I have zero familiarity with personally, but the killing and butchering of a large animal like a bull is a big task. A bull like this, 7 years old, would be expected to weigh in excess of 2,000 pounds. You can imagine hoisting an animal onto an altar like that, even after dismembering it, would have required significant work. And so, you know, we read over these verses, but if you stop and think about what it looked like and what it took, this was an effort. And Gideon accomplished it again with the help of 10 of his servants. Now, in verse 28, the townspeople wake up the next morning. They see the altar of Baal broken down, the Asherah beside it cut down, and they're not happy about it. They want to find out who has done it. There's an investigation, and they find out that it's Gideon, the son of Joash. I didn't mention before, but Gideon's father's name, Joash, means Yahweh is strong. But again, this was an altar that was, by the account, on his property or part of the land here. So they approach Joash, and what did they demand from Joash? What do they want to do to Gideon for having torn down the altar? They want to put him to death, which is ironic because according to Deuteronomy 13, the punishment for worshiping an idol was death. So you can see again how topsy-turvy the society was at this time, where someone who tore down what God had forbade, they're demanding their death, whereas that was the punishment God had intended for someone who worshiped an idol in the first place. So how does Joash respond? Well, I think favorably, the way that a reasonable person should respond. And it's essentially by saying, shouldn't Baal be able to take care of himself? It's his altar that was torn down. So let him, you know, seek justice or vengeance in this case and take care of whoever it is that did it. And responding this way, Joash preserves his son's life. And Gideon is now given another name, Jerubbaal, which means let Baal contend against him. So in this, Gideon, in that name, becomes a living reminder of Baal's impotence, that Baal wasn't able to do anything about his altar being torn down. And then remember, as we'll talk about in just a minute, that it's this clan, the Abiezrites, who were at one moment ready to kill Gideon, form the core of the army that he's going to amass and take to the scene of the battle in the valley of Jezreel. And so, again, they turn from wanting to have Gideon killed to being the nucleus of the army that he will soon raise among these northern tribes. So now in verse 33, we start to see the beginnings of the battle we'll read about in the next chapter, in chapter 7. So the actual battle doesn't start till verse 19 of chapter 7. But now we're starting to see in verse 33, men being called up in order to battle against God's enemies. But these enemies are amassing themselves in the valley of Jezreel, which again was the same place where Deborah and Barak's forces fought against the enemies of Sisera back in chapter 4. Gideon, clothed with the Spirit, the narrative says, sounds a trumpet, and beckons his fellow clansmen, Abiezrites, to follow him. And again, these were some of the same people who had previously wanted to kill him for destroying their idols. Notice, too, that others in Manasseh, so again, Gideon's clan was part of the bigger tribe of Manasseh. So the call goes out to the rest of Manasseh and also the tribes of Asher, Zebulun, and Naphtali, and they went up to meet him. We don't yet know about numbers until the next chapter, but we find out that the starting number of Gideon's army was 32,000. And does anyone know how that number, the starting number, compares to the number of enemies that they were going to fight against? Which I don't think we find out until chapter 8. I'll give you a hint. It's verse 10, where we find out that 120,000 men who had been killed, but there were still 15,000 remaining. So I think that's why. Yeah.
At least.
Starting with 32,000, so bad odds. And as we probably won't talk about tonight, but maybe next week, those odds get really bad, really quick. Yeah. So they're amassing here and preparing for battle. Imagine how daunting that force would have been, even with 32,000 men. You see your enemy, and it's, what is it, four times the number of fighters that you have. How daunting that would have been. So it's no wonder then that Gideon says, at least no wonder to me, in verse 36, if you will save Israel by my hand, as you have said, behold, I am laying a fleece of wool on threshing floor. He asked for the sign where at first he wants the fleece to be moist and the surrounding ground to be dry, which he discovers to be true the next morning. And the fleece was so wet that he was able to wring it out and get a bowl full of water the first time. And then he asked God in verse 39, first saying, let not your anger burn against me, and now requests that the fleece be dry and the ground be wet. God performs both of these signs, to Kyle's point earlier, which I think speaks to what God knew about Gideon's heart and about his motive for requesting these signs, I think, which was pure and truly wanting to bolster his faith. And in this, we see Gideon displaying faith, but growing in his faith in a short period of time. So God performs these two signs, and I previously mentioned, you know, the motive in Matthew chapter 16, where some requested a sign, but to test God, to test Jesus out of an impure motive. And we can see the difference there in the biblical narrative. And so I think, again, to Kyle's point, that When we're honestly seeking for the evidence that God has laid before us, he will respond very favorably to that. Yes, sir.
Oh, he raised his hand too.
It's interesting the sequence of the events with the way God talks to Gideon, because he says very little, at least that's recorded here. But he says, "The Lord is with you, O valiant warrior." And then it's almost as though Gideon interrupts him, and then he begins talking again in verse 14. "The Lord looked at him and said, 'Go in this your strength and deliver Israel from the hand of Midian. Have I not sent you?'" And then Gideon talks for quite a while. And then he tells him to go knock down the idol. And it basically looks like, "I want you to go defeat the enemies of the Lord, and I'm going to start a fight for you. So I'll get them all stirred up and bring them right up to you." And then we see what happens afterwards. It's very similar in a shadow sense to Jesus, because Jesus stirred up the people who were going to murder him so that he could defeat them, so that he could defeat Satan. He provoked them to anger and jealousy. Same way here in verse 33. "Then all the Midianites and the Amalekites and the sons of the east assembled themselves," because they're angry. I'm assuming that's why, because they're angry about this. He just spit in Baal's face, and Jehovah is the one who's doing this.
Okay. All right, that's an interesting parallel. Bring that up between Gideon
and then later account of Jesus in the New Testament. Chair.
"25 down to 47, it takes 10 men to undo that altar at night. There's a lot of work going on. So he's already put forth, after that previous conversation he had, he already puts forth quite a bit. He goes and gets 10 others that he's directing, and they're working at night to make that happen, knowing full well he could end up dead the next day. But he has enough faith to do that. It's kind of interesting to me that after that, we still go through the whole thing of the fleece. But that's after, it looks like, if this is written chronologically, it appears to be, in verse 34, where he blows the trumpet and assembles them. And then, I don't know, it's almost like, I've got these people, I've sent out the messages, and he's going back for confirmation again, maybe? I'm not real sure what it is he's struggling, but I'm not sure.
I can relate to that because, you know, with such a momentous occasion, I mean, I've not faced anything like this, but I think it's natural to have second thoughts and to reassess your motives and how you got to the position that you're in. And so I think it's I can see how he would ask for signs. Yeah, more signs. All right, we just have a couple of minutes left. This just depicts the tribes that were recruited to help. And again, the battle's going to take place here. So our takeaway for tonight, briefly, with the few minutes that we have left, hitting on a point that we've addressed already, that Kyle brought up first, and it's God's patient provision to Gideon of these proofs and assurances which motivated his faithful obedience. And for us, God has also provided proofs and assurances to motivate our belief in him, which will result in a faithful, obedient life. You think about Psalm 19, where we can look at the heavens, how they declare the glory of God. But then that psalm talks about the law of the Lord. It's perfect. And so not only has his creation pointed to his existence, but he's given us his will in his word to understand what he expects from us. Unlike Gideon, we're not in a place to ask God for specific additional evidence besides what he's already provided. I think about the rich man's request in Luke 16, after he was told that there was going to be no relief for him. He asks Abraham in verse 27, "I beg you, Father, to send him to my father's house, Lazarus. I have five brothers, so that he may warn them, lest they also come to this place of torment." But Abraham said, "They have Moses and the prophets. Let them hear them." He says, "No, Father Abraham, but if someone goes to them from the dead, they will repent." A sign.
Verse 31, he said to him, if they do not hear Moses and the prophets, neither will they be convinced that someone should rise from the dead. So for us, let's be thankful and content with God's word that he's given to us and honestly search it for the truth that he's revealed. I think that's all for our time. I appreciate so much y'all's attention and for your comments.